Hello and welcome to this Essential Knowledge Update podcast from the Royal College of GPs. My name is Sally Higginbottom and today I am interviewing Dr. Kevin Fernando, a GP with a special interest in diabetes and medical education based in North Berwick, Edinburgh. Hello, Kevin.
Morning, Sally.
So the module we're discussing today is based on the British Society of Gastroenterology guidance on abnormal liver function tests from the end of last year. Can you give us a bit of background on liver disease?
Liver disease is a real ticking time bomb. Whilst mortality from cardiovascular disease, respiratory disease, and cancer has fallen over the last 30, 40 years, mortality from liver disease has actually increased fourfold since the 1970s. The main causes of liver disease remain alcohol and chronic viral hepatitis, but the obesity epidemic has driven an increase in conditions such as metabolic syndrome, which may lead to NAFLD, which is also now a leading cause of liver disease.
So there's a big burden of disease out there, but interpreting liver function tests is tricky. The module describes three different categories of LFTs. Can you run through them and give us a quick refresh?
Liver function tests, or more accurately, liver blood tests, are the most frequently requested investigations in primary care. We have three different categories of liver blood tests. First of all, we have the hepatobiliary enzymes. So these are your ALT and your AST blood tests. And they really reflect any ongoing liver injury. For example, secondary to viral hepatitis, or in an individual who has perhaps taken a paracetamol overdose. Bilirubin, albumin, and INR reflect the liver synthetic function. So for example, in those with advanced alcohol-related liver disease, there's reduced production of clotting factors, resulting in a high INR and a bleeding tendency. And then finally, platelets reflect the degree of liver fibrosis. So again, in advanced liver disease, we often see thrombocytopenia secondary to hypersplenism as a result of the advanced liver disease.
That's really helpful because we often say liver function tests when many of them are not actual function tests, don't we?
Absolutely. So correct terminology should actually be liver blood tests rather than liver function tests.
Okay. And can you recap the difference between cholestatic and hepatitic enzyme rises?
Sure. So cholestatic enzyme rises suggest an underlying obstructive form of liver disease, such as gallstones or malignancy. And in a cholestatic enzyme rise, we would typically see elevated alkaline phosphatase, ALP, and also gamma GT. However, hepatitic enzyme rises suggest more acute liver injury, such as viral hepatitis or paracetamol overdose. And you would typically see a raised ALT and AST. But in reality, as we all know, working in primary care, there's often a mixed pattern of liver tests and there's much crossover between these enzyme rises.
Yes, and I find gamma GT particularly helpful in unpicking where the alk-phos has come from. Because my understanding is if the gamma GT is normal, then the alk-phos isn't of hepatic origin. Is that right?
Absolutely. Gamma GT can be a helpful test, but as we know, it also has a very high false positive rate too. The Ballot study was a UK primary care based study in Birmingham, published a number of years ago, looking at individuals with abnormal LFTs, but not known to have liver disease. And what that study found was, yes, gamma GT did have a very high false positive rate, but actually was very sensitive to alcohol intake, as we all know. And in fact, one of the best roles for gamma GT is actually it's a very good predictor of adverse outcomes, particularly mortality, in those with established liver disease. So as you pointed out, it's actually useful checking the gamma GT if the alk-phos is elevated. So if the gamma GT is normal, but the alk-phos is elevated, think bone and perhaps check calcium and go down that route. However, if both the alk-phos and gamma GT are high, then think liver and further investigate as appropriate with a liver screen and perhaps a liver ultrasound scan.
So getting slightly abnormal liver blood tests back is a common problem we face, most of us, pretty much every day in primary care. How do you approach this?
mildly abnormal LFTs are a bane of my life. Every week I have a DocMan inbox full of mildly abnormal LFTs, which I don't know exactly what to do with. So I normally tick repeat 4 weeks and hope for the best. So what the guidance tells us, yes, they are a commonly requested test, but they're perhaps overly requested. They're checked almost as a measure of well-being. So liver disease is often silent, as we know, until quite advanced. But if there are non-specific symptoms present, such as malaise, anorexia, etc., these can be suggestive of underlying liver disease. So it can be helpful to check liver blood tests. We should check liver blood tests, of course, in those with features of chronic liver disease, such as peripheral stigmata of chronic disease, spider nevi, etc., and in those at risk of liver disease, particularly those with a family history of conditions such as hemochromatosis or those who drink alcohol to excess. Also, many individuals on potentially hepatotoxic drugs such as the DMARDs for rheumatoid arthritis, we should check their liver blood tests. And actually, our patients with inflammatory bowel disease, we should consider checking their liver blood tests too, because they actually have a 10% chance of developing PSE, primary sclerosing cholangitis. So it is useful to check their liver blood tests regularly too.
So that's a lot of potential blood tests we're doing. Yeah. And as you mentioned, the sort of reflex recheck in a month strategy is something a lot of us often do. But what's the evidence around that?
So I'll go back to this ballot study that I mentioned. So this was a Birmingham primary care-based study. So very generalizable to the patients me and you would see on a day-to-day basis. So they looked at a cohort of nearly 1,400 patients in primary care with abnormal LFTs, but not known to have underlying liver disease. And what they actually did is they repeated that liver blood panel every month for 2 years. And what they found was that liver panel did not improve. So the liver test remained persistently abnormal for that 2 year period. So the message for us in primary care is there's no use persisting with that strategy that I often follow of just simply repeating the blood test in 4 weeks. We need to have a heuristic in mind to try and act in a timely manner on those abnormal LFTs and consider appropriate further investigations.
So what would your standard next step be? Obviously, it depends on the particular clinical situation, but in someone with no obvious cause for their abnormal blood tests, what would you have in mind as your first set of investigations?
So the British Society of Gastroenterology guidance published earlier this year provides us with a useful algorithm for the different enzyme or other liver blood test patterns we might see. So I'd be very much guided by that algorithm. It's an open access article, so free for us all to download in primary care. Well worth downloading, print it out, even have laminated on your wall. So if I do see someone, say, with an elevated ALT or that sort of more hepatitic picture, I would perhaps initially pursue the NAFLD route of that algorithm and consider a further liver screen. But also the algorithm tells us to consider a liver ultrasound, but also a non-invasive measurement of fibrosis. And in particular, they mention the possibility of an ELF test, which is a blood test, and it stands for the Enhanced Liver Fibrosis Test. And it's in essence a non-invasive method of assessing any degree of liver fibrosis. This is also mentioned in the NICE NAFLD guideline published in 2016. But unfortunately, the ELF, and many of our listeners will also be familiar with the FibroScan test. This is an ultrasound-based scan that also assesses fibrosis of the liver. Both of these tests, the ELF and the FibroScan, unfortunately are not readily available in primary care. So that does present some barriers to the further investigation of individuals with abnormal LFTs.
Because indeed, once we've followed these pathways and checked, I mean, in my head, I always think I mustn't forget hepatitis and ultrasound. Once you've decided it's probably non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, are you going to refer all those patients? What are you doing on a practical level if you can't get fibrosis testing in primary care?
So a useful additional blood test, which is increasingly reported routinely by many laboratories, is the AST-ALT ratio. So the British Society of Gastroenterology guideline does recommend the use of the AST-ALT ratio if individuals do not have ready access to either an ELF or a FibroScan. And what the AST-ALT ratio is useful in telling us is the likelihood of progression of any underlying fatty liver disease. So in areas perhaps where there isn't ready access to either the ELF or the FibroScan test, what the British Society of Gastroenterology does suggest we consider is use of both the NAFLD fibrosis score, which is a website where you can type in your patient's characteristics, results of blood tests, and it will tell you the likelihood of underlying fibrosis. This is a free access website, so well worth having a look at that, having a link on your desktop. Alternatively, or in addition to the NAFLD score, the BSG, British Society of Gastroenterology, also recommend use of the AST-ALT ratio. Now, this is helpful in assessing the likelihood of progression of NAFLD. So if the AST-ALT ratio is less than 1, then that suggests a low risk of progression of NAFLD. Whereas if the AST-ALT ratio is greater than 1, that suggests a higher risk of progression. And these individuals, the BSG suggests we should consider referral to our hepatology colleagues. And if that AST-ALT ratio is higher than 1.5, then that's actually strongly suggested of alcohol-related liver disease. So this ratio can be a useful assessment in the absence of either an ELF or a FibroScan. And certainly my local laboratory in Edinburgh does routinely report this now.
That's really helpful. And we could possibly ask our labs to add that if that's not something that's happening in our areas. You mentioned these are patients who need referring to secondary care. Who else would you think of referring and who needs urgent referral?
The British Society of Gastroenterology guidance does suggest if there's no clear underlying cause to the abnormal LFTs, we should consider referring all patients. You know, clearly, in the current climate we work with, this would overwhelm our gastroenterology colleagues, and I personally don't think it is an appropriate path of management. Who we should be referring, though, are anyone that we suspect underlying malignancy, of course, or advanced liver failure. And the BSG do provide us with a useful algorithm for these individuals. So if there's any evidence of liver synthetic failure, so marked jaundice, low albumin, prolonged INR, these individuals do need urgent, perhaps same day, secondary care referral. And again, if you suspect malignancy, so if there's a history of weight loss and marked cholestasis, particularly painless jaundice, absolutely these individuals need an urgent ultrasound scan and an urgent 2-week wait referral to our secondary care colleagues.
The module also talks about children, which feels like a completely different subject to me, but their guidance also does cover children. We test liver blood tests much less frequently in children, but are there any top tips from here that you think would be helpful to focus on?
I have to be honest, I don't often check liver blood tests in children, and if I do, they are often mildly abnormal, particularly alkaline phosphatase, usually related to growth spurts. So whilst we can check liver blood tests in children, the use of these non-invasive markers such as ELF and FibroScan have not been sufficiently validated in children. So in those children with abnormal LFTs, we probably should have a low threshold for contacting our pediatric gastroenterology colleagues for further advice. Unfortunately, with the obesity epidemic, we are seeing NAFLD even in younger age groups as well. So, of course, in primary care, we need to continue to do what we do best and reinforce the all-important lifestyle advice and signpost families and children to local dietetic services and other initiatives to promote healthy eating and weight loss.
Absolutely. So what were the key learning points for you in this module?
Well, really, the key messages I took away from this module is that simply repeating that LFT panel monthly is ineffective. Abnormal LFTs are really unlikely to resolve spontaneously and need a more timely assessment. And that algorithm within the British Society of Gastroenterology guideline I found very pragmatic to facilitate me to target investigations depending on the pattern of abnormal LFTs I was seeing.
And was there anything that surprised you?
Yeah. Well, not really, to be honest. I thought that the guidance was very sensible, did offer a sort of a pragmatic approach to the interpretation and management of LFTs. But specifically talking about the NICE NAFLD guidance now, what did crop up again was the disconnect we often see in NICE guidelines, where perhaps what NICE would like us to do in primary care isn't readily available to us in primary care. For example, the ELF and the FibroScan tests.
So yes, so hopefully we will be able to get some non-invasive fibrosis testing, but in many areas, not yet. So thank you for your time, Kevin, and thank you for listening to this podcast from the RCGP.